From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, film director David Cronenberg. His films include Scanners, Dead Ringers, The Dead Zone, The Fly, and Naked Lunch. His latest film, A History of Violence, which recently received 2 Academy Award nominations, is out now on DVD. The film asks whether some people are inherently violent and whether they can change. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film V for Vendetta, starring Natalie Portman, and rock historian Ed Ward remembers Reparata and the Delrons, the group he calls the last girl group of the 1960s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. A History of Violence, the David Cronenberg movie about the origins, consequences, and temptations of violence, was released this week on DVD. Our guest on today's show is the film's director, David Cronenberg. Cronenberg's earlier films include some envelope-pushing entries in the realms of relatively realistic science fiction. There's the mind-altering, body-altering future TV of Videodrome, the mind-controlling human weapons of Scanners and the Dead Zone, the scientific experiment gone wrong in the remake of The Fly starring Jeff Goldblum, and the reality-warping interactive video game of Existenz. Cronenberg's other films, outside the sci-fi genre, include Dead Ringers, The Naked Lunch, M. Butterfly, and Crash, the twisted psychosexual drama about people excited by car crashes and injuries, not the film of the same name that just won the Oscar. A History of Violence was nominated for two Oscars at that same Academy Awards, one to William Hurt for Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role, the other to Josh Olson for Best Screenplay based on previously published material. Terry spoke with David Cronenberg when A History of Violence was first released last year. The central questions in the film include whether some people are inherently violent and whether they can change. The film stars Viggo Mortensen as Tom Stahl, a husband, father, and owner of a diner in a small town in Indiana. He becomes an instant hero when he kills two armed robbers who are threatening the lives of everyone in the diner. Soon after, a mysterious man with a scarred face shows up at the diner and claims that Tom isn't who he says he is. The mysterious man is played by Ed Harris.
Well, welcome to Stahl's. Would you gentlemen like some coffee?
You're the hero.
I don't know, sir.
You're the big hero. Sure took care of those two bad men.
Really don't like talking about it, sir. We're trying to get back to normal here. So can I offer you gentlemen some coffee?
Sure. Give me some coffee. Make it black.
Yes, sir.
Joey.
And your friends?
They don't drink coffee. He doesn't agree with them. Joey.
Joey.
My
name's Tom, sir.
Of course it is.
David Cronenberg, welcome back to Fresh Air. A History
Thanks.
Of Violence is basically saying that everyone, or at least most people, have the potential to be violent, but some people are forced to become violent to fight a bully, whereas others just seem to have a taste for it. Do you believe that most people do have that potential?
Well, I think it's innate in us, just genetically, that we are capable of violence. But in specific cases, you have to go on a case-by-case basis. But I think in the movie, we're really examining the ambivalent attitude that people have towards violence. It's, you know, you sort of don't want it to come and visit you in your house. But on the other hand, you might find it rather exhilarating when you see it visited on other people, either in the movies or alive. So I think the movie is a meditation on that ambivalence rather than, you know, saying anything very specific about genetics, let's say.
Well, you know, talking about that ambivalence about violence, I think movies themselves reflect that because violent movies are incredibly popular. People seem to like violent scenes in movies. At the same time, there's always these kind of attempts to crack down against violence in movies and, you know, mm-hmm. fear that violence in movies will lead to violence in real life. How does that whole infatuation with violence in movies, how did that affect your style of shooting the violent sequences?
Well, rather than having an overarching theory of where violence in cinema should go or shouldn't go, or even thinking about my old movies and what people expect from me or don't expect from me, getting rid of all that, I think only about what is in this movie. And in it I say, okay, where does the violence come from? Well, it comes from specific characters. What does the violence mean to those characters? Where did they learn to be violent? That's really was the ruling factor in deciding how to portray it. And I came to the conclusion that for these people, I'm quoting a line from the movie, business would come first. You know, it's business for them. It's a criminal enterprise. It's not sadistic pleasure. It's not ballet. It's not aesthetics. It's not martial arts. It's business. get it over with, get it done. If you have to kill somebody or hurt somebody, you do it as efficiently as possible. And normally using techniques that you've learned on the street. You know, you haven't been trained professionally. You haven't been in the army or anything like that. So that was the tone that I gave to the violence in the movie. And it's very intimate. The theory being that when you want to kill someone, you get close to them. You don't get far away from them. You actually get as close to them as you can. So the violence in the movie is very, very short and quick and realistic. No slow motion, no multiple cuts and so on. And it's very strangely intimate and very physical.
What did you have to learn about guns and fighting in order to direct the film?
Well, I really started only learning about guns through movies because in Canada, you know, we have very strict gun laws, gun control laws, and I actually never held a pistol in my hand until I was making a movie, actually. And in terms of killing on the street, well, I did find a couple of DVDs on the internet that purport to teach you how to do exactly that, you know, how to kill somebody with your bare hands if you're attacked, mugged, robbed. And that was also one of the places where I found that sense of intimacy with the person that you're trying to kill. The whole idea of those was that you move into the person. You don't step away so that they can shoot you or stab you or whatever. You actually get close to them so that you can touch them, feel them, smell them, see their sweat, see their pores. And from that vantage point, you actually are much more capable of inflicting damage and surprise on an attacker than you would think.
Was it kind of creepy to be watching this DVD about how to kill someone?
Well, it's presented in a very matter-of-fact, pragmatic kind of way, you know, with a great patina of professionalism and so on. It wasn't just one, it was several. And so it kind of decreases the creepiness. It's sort of...
The presumption is you're the innocent victim who's learning how to kill in self-defense, and you're a good guy. No bad guys are watching this DVD.
That's right, and you're getting... And you're seeing testimonials from old-age pensioners in Miami, you know, who are saying, I feel much more secure walking down the street now that I know I can kill, you know? So it kind of takes the sinisterness out of it, which in a way makes it even more sinister, I suppose. And, of course, I have no idea whether I could ever do that based on what I saw or not, you know? I mean, and certainly one hopes never to have to figure that out.
Now, A History of Violence is, it's kind of like a Western. And in part because there's a character in it who has renounced violence but is forced back into it in the way that a lot of characters in Westerns have been, like Johnny Guitar, you know, the guy who gives up guns but has to pick them up again because of threats against him and someone mm-hmm. he loves. Was your style of shooting this movie inspired by Westerns?
Not really the style, but certainly one of the things that attracted me to the project was that kind of iconic Americana tone that there is, and it's not just Westerns but gangster movies as well, and it's kind of you know, America's mythology of itself, which it has very successfully exported to the rest of the world through its movies and its art and so on. The man standing alone with the gun protecting himself and his family against the bad guys and taking vengeance and having that be very justified because of what he is, and taking the law into his own hands is another very American theme, which is not particularly obvious in other countries, including Canada. You know, the idea that you, at a certain moment of crisis, you must take the law into your own hands, that sense of individualism and righteousness, the righteousness of the individual is foreign to many countries, most countries, I would say.
I really like the opening shot of the movie, and when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is going to be good. And in the opening shot, two guys are walking out the door of a motel room, and they're walking into bright sunlight, and they really have to squint. The sunlight really hits them. And you can tell that they've come from a world that's, like, really dark into this bright light. And and you figure there's something really dark about these guys, and there certainly is. Can you talk about what you try to do in an opening shot to establish the tone, the mood? Because how important do you think that opening shot is?
Well, You know, it's interesting. This movie, I don't have an opening title sequence that's separate from the movie, and I've often talked about my enjoying doing that. That is to say, making a title sequence that isn't a scene from the movie, so that people are not put in the position of reading titles and watching the movie at the same time, and using that title sequence as a kind of vestibule, you know, to kind of ease the audience into the movie from being in their own world, and using that title sequence to set a tone that will set them up for the movie. In this case, I shot that scene, and it's a single shot that lasts for 4 minutes, and it's quite complex little shot with dollying and craning and a few other things. Not for spectacle, it's quite tight and intimate, but it does go through some very difficult little moments. And there's a kind of strange, languidly sinister tone to these two guys, and they take their time talking, and I don't rush them. And a lot of space between the words and so on. And I really like that tone so much that even though I did shoot coverage for it, which is to say did other close-ups and so on so that I could tighten the scene or whatever by cutting into it, I thought that the single shot worked so well that way that I would leave it and not cut into it. And at that point I thought, well, here's a perfect opening scene that I think I could put titles over in a way that I haven't done for many, many years. And then, therefore, this shot would have to do two things. It would have to be the first scene in the movie, and it would have to have that vestibule effect that I normally use a title sequence to get. That is, it would be a scene that would tell the audience a lot about what they were getting into with this movie. And interestingly enough, too, there's no music over this shot, which is also, I think, rather rare these days. So it turned out to be, I think, quite an important shot and quite important sequence for the movie, because it does set up really an awful lot the more you think about it.
David Cronenberg speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with David Cronenberg. His movie, A History of Violence, has just come out on DVD.
There's two sex scenes in A History of Violence that are both very passionate. And one of them is kind of playful and about role-playing, and the other is much more in anger and in violence, but still very, very passionate. Actors, and both scenes reveal a lot about the characters. Actors are always talking about how difficult it is to perform the sex scenes and how self-conscious they are and uncomfortable. What about directing scenes like that? What are the challenges in directing them?
Well, the vulnerability, both physically and psychologically, of actors in a sex scene is probably pretty obvious to most people, but there is the same thing going on with the director. You know, if a director is very sexually inhibited or repressed or shy or embarrassed or anything else, it inevitably is communicated to the crew and to the actors, and it makes them be the same, and therefore you don't get a very good scene probably. So it's really a matter of being funny, being loose, being specific, giving the actors the sense that you know what you're doing. In my case, I make sure that the actors can look at a monitor and see the recordings of what they just shot at any moment, so they know exactly what they look like and what's going on. No secrets, no surprises to hit them later. And it's just being very gentle and supportive, you know, and still, of course, getting what we want, but never letting go until we've got what we want. There's a scene on the stairs, sex on the stairs, very hard wooden stairs between Vigo and Maria Bello, and that was physically very difficult too, because she was really, they were both actually quite battered and bruised after that, because it took a day and a half to shoot that. And those were real wooden stairs. And at one point I asked my stunt coordinator if he had stunt pads, and he said, he laughed, he said he'd never been asked for stunt pads for a sex scene before, but in fact we couldn't use them because, you know, you'd see them, so they had to do them without them. But yeah, I think it is a challenge. I think some directors are very inhibited, and you can tell. It gets communicated.
Is it hard to not feel like, you know, you're a voyeur or a peeping Tom when you're setting up a scene like that?
You are totally a voyeur and a peeping Tom, and it's better if you just admit it. You know, that, I mean, because at that point you are the audience as well, and you are watching. You're watching sex. I mean, it's not real sex, but you're watching a simulation of sex. So this is something, once again, that is joked about on my set. I mean, we all are in on the joke. There's no, you know, nobody who's not. So all of those aspects of it are out in the open, and there's no, you know, nothing's covered up.
Are these the most passionate sex scenes that you've ever done, as opposed to sex scenes that are about the potential for contagion?
No, I mean, I think that there was a wonderful scene between Jeremy Irons and Genevieve Bujold in Dead Ringers, for
example.
Oh,
sure.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. was pretty passionate and mm-hmm. pretty, you know, intense. So I've done that before. It's just, but each scene, of course, is unique. And, for example, the cheerleader scene, as we call it, the role-playing scene where Maria dresses up as a cheerleader, and the idea is that they're going to create a past for themselves that they never had, as because they were not teenagers together. He came to town later. It does have resonances for the whole theme of identity and role playing and so on in the movie. So it's not just a sex scene for a sex. It really pleases me that the only two sex scenes in the movie take place between a couple who have been married for 20 years and have two kids, you know, because certainly in American movies, it's like adolescent sex or forget it. You know, it's like if you're married, your sex life is gone, not worth filming.
You've written some of the movies you've directed, but A History of Violence is an adaptation of a graphic novel. You were approached with the screen adaptation of the graphic novel and decided to direct the film. Is there a difference for you in how you approach material that you've written as opposed to approaching material that you have not? And I'm wondering, in a way, if you feel freer to take liberties with either of the two.
No, I feel free to take liberties with everything. You know, I mean, to me, that's what I have to do. At my first adaptation that was The Dead Zone, an adaptation of a Stephen King bestseller. And before that, all of the movies I had made, I'd written myself. They were original screenplays. And I felt that I immediately became obvious to me that in order to be faithful to that book, I had to betray the book. In other words, there is no way of translating a book to the screen, because the two media are so completely different. There is no dictionary for that translation. You know, you really have to reinvent it totally for the screen. And what you do is you try to capture the ambience, you know, this tone of the book, rather than be faithful literally, because if you try to do it literally, faithfully, you're doomed to failure. So taking liberties with adapted material was as necessary as when you've written it yourself.
I'm glad you mentioned The Dead Zone. This starred Christopher Walken as somebody who, when he touches someone, he can see their future. This was relatively early in Walken's career, and since then, you know, a lot of comics and impressionists have affectionately mocked his very strange pattern of speaking, where accents fall on very unlikely words within sentences. Were you mm-hmm. aware of that when you were directing him, and did that throw you at all?
No, I mean, I think it's a brilliant performance. He had won an Oscar at that point
for The Deer Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a fine actor.
Oh, and yeah, I think, he's great.
Yeah, you know, but every actor has a specific kind of rhythm and diction, and you develop a relationship in the editing room with the actor that's a unique relationship. Nobody has that relationship other than a director who's editing an actor, because you live with that diction for, well, weeks or months that you're editing the movie. And you become so attuned to that. I mean, for example, Jeff Goldblum also has some very unique and specific speech patterns that are not like anybody else's, you know, and you have to deal with that when you're editing. How much do you go with it? How much do you try to force it into a more familiar rhythm and so on?
Can you think of an example, either with Christopher Walken or with Jeff Goldblum, about how those rhythms made you need to make a difficult decision, how it was unpredictable and it threw you?
No, never. I mean, it's always, it would delight me and surprise me.
Oh, how about an example of how it delighted you then?
When Chris wakes up from his coma in the dead zone and they tell him that he's been gone for 5 years. He says, 5 years. You know, I didn't really capture it. I haven't listened to it for quite a few years, but there was just a wonderful, the surprise, you know, the shock and the horror of it all was expressed just in those two words, and it was the rhythm between the two words, just having two words to work with, that expressed that. And it was, you know, it was just fantastic.
David Cronenberg, director of A History of Violence, out now on DVD. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with David Cronenberg in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
We're listening to music from Reparata and the Delrons. Coming up, Ed Ward remembers that 1960s girl group. Also, David Edelstein reviews V for Vendetta, and we continue our interview with David Cronenberg. His latest film, A History of Violence, is out now on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today we're listening back to Terry's 2005 interview with David Cronenberg, director of A History of Violence, which just came out on DVD. Many of Cronenberg's previous films, almost all of them really, have dealt with violence and sexual fantasy in one form or another. The underground porn in Videodrome, the illicit and violent video games of X's Dens, the kinky car crash recreations of Crash. Terry asked David Cronenberg about his willingness and eagerness to push certain boundaries on film.
You've made a lot of films with very dark and potent fantasies in them. And I want to quote something that you've said. You've said, as an artist, one is not a citizen of society. An artist is bound to explore every aspect of human experience, the darkest concerns. You cannot worry about what the structure of your own particular segment of society considers bad behavior or good behavior. You have no social responsibility whatsoever. First of all, do you still agree with that?
Absolutely, I do.
Why do you think it's important for an artist to not be inhibited when it comes to exploring the darkest parts of their imagination?
Well, society does not tend to encourage people to tell the truth. Society is, in general, is interested in sustaining itself. You are not encouraged really to tell the truth. You're encouraged to be a good citizen in the bad sense, which is to say an obedient citizen, one who toes the line, one who sort of accepts the standards of society without question. And this is a natural thing. All societies have this kind of gyroscopic need to sustain themselves, maintain themselves, and that imparts a certain stability. But at the same time, if you only go with that, then you never get improvements, you never get corrections of injustices and so on. So you need the words of the rebels, the artists, the people who will not accept reality as it is presented, but figure that there's something else going on. There's something other things going. I don't mean I'm not talking about conspiracy theories. I'm talking about looking for the truth about the way things work and how those things might be improved. So you need both forces though. You know, for civilization, you need both of them. I mean, in the Freudian formula, civilization is repression. You know, repression of the most base, primitive instincts. But you don't get civilization without a rebellion against repression as well, as in the Freudian formula that will come from the unconscious and dreams and so on.
So are you working under the premise that most people have very dark thoughts or fantasies that they wouldn't admit to in public, and that it's in part your job to talk about those things that people have but they won't necessarily say that they do?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you imagine just taking anybody asleep and drilling a hole in their forehead and having their dreams projected onto a screen for a couple of thousand people as though it were an entertainment, what do you think you'd see from anybody? You know, you'd see some boring stuff, but I think you'd see some amazing things as well, you know, perhaps quite shocking, and it would come from straight citizens of all kinds, you know, and it's all there.
A couple of your movies are almost about that, like Scanners in a way.
Yeah,
almost operates on that principle.
Yeah, there is a hole drilled in a forehead in Scanners, and I suppose I've been taking my metaphor that I just gave you from that.
So if we're operating on the premise that you've done a lot of scenes over the years that are about these dark places that we don't want to admit exist in our minds, which of those scenes has gotten the strongest reaction from viewers and has proved to be like most troubling to viewers? Mm.
Well, I think there's some scenes in Crash that really have disturbed a lot of people. That movie caused a lot of controversy in various countries, including this one. And
well, Crash is a movie about people who get turned on basically by car crashes in which they or other people are injured. And so
yeah, that it's but they're not exactly turned on. You know, they are and they aren't. It's really, don't forget, everybody in that sort of strange invented subculture has been in an accident, a sort of a life transforming accident.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as though in order to come to terms with the fact that they survived that and perhaps were deformed by that, that they have to relive it in a more controlled way. And they find that the only people they can relate to are other people who have undergone the same experience. So, you know, in a way, the movie is a metaphor for those people who undergo these life-shattering experiences, whether it's being comrades in arms in a war or whether it's people who have had to fight off the same disease as you have. Finding people who are, as I say, almost a subculture, who are the only ones who can understand what you've gone through, and finding strange ways to relive that experience and so come to understand it.
And transform it so that it has a different meaning.
Yes, that's right.
Or
transform it so that it has any meaning, because you might think that the thing that struck you is meaningless. And we are creatures who do not like to feel that things are meaningless, and we are very prone to giving things meaning. Meaning really only comes from us in the universe. As far as I'm concerned, the only place that meaning comes from in the universe is the human mind. Without the human mind, there is no meaning in the universe, as far as I'm concerned. So we are the inventors of meaning, and we are the only consumers of it. I mean, your average bunny rabbit in the grass does not need meaning to exist, but we seem to need it.
You've done several horror films. I mean, they're not standard horror films, but they're like your take on horror films. And you've said that the horror in horror films is about the inevitability of death. Do you think your understanding of death and your way of addressing it has changed as you've gotten older?
Well, I think my understanding has gotten deeper and more profound. Yeah, I think so. I don't know that that really necessarily will change the way that I deal with death in films. I said very early on that I think as early as Scanners, I seem to recall saying to somebody, every time I kill somebody in my movie, I'm really rehearsing my own death, you know, or it's like a trial run to see how it would feel, to see how I would feel. And I think there's still some truth in that. You know, that's why I don't take death lightly in my films. It's always a very significant event.
Does it give you a sense of control to be directing a death scene? Because we really have no control over death, but as a director, for those moments you do.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons that directors become directors and actors become actors. Imagine the sense of control you have as an actor to sort of die doing 10 takes in a movie and then you get up and you're still alive. You know, it gives you a feeling of some kind of immortality, even though you know it's a false sense, and it gives you a feeling that perhaps in some way you will be more prepared for your own death, having rehearsed it so many times.
Now, I was reading a little bit about your father's death. He had what sounds like a horrible disease where the disease attacks the body's ability to process calcium, and your bones become so thin and brittle that they could break just turning over in bed, which is what started happening to him. I don't know when your father died, but, you know, when I see your movie The Fly, I always think about how the body can betray you, because the Jeff Goldblum character, who mixes his genes with the genes of a fly and starts to transform himself into a fly, his body starts to putrefy. And it's a very disturbing movie because of that.
Yeah. Well, it's once again, it's like it's rehearsing, you know. At the time, people wanted that to very much represent AIDS, and they were sure that I was creating that as a metaphor for AIDS. And I said, well, really, it's more like a metaphor for aging and the kind of thing that everybody has to undergo. We all have this one disease, you know. It's called mortality. And we are absolutely doomed to play that out. But once again, I mean, that character starts to feel that he's not just dying, he's transforming, he's becoming something else. And of course, in a certain narrative sense in that movie, he really is becoming something else. But he's also transforming into oblivion, let's say. And that's something that's very difficult for people to accept, you know, their non-existence. And so much of art and religion and politics has to do with evading that reality, to not have to accept one's own personal oblivion.
Are there scenes in movies that you saw when you were young that disturbed you, that you were afraid to go to sleep afterwards, or those images would kind of come up and bother you and you couldn't get rid of them?
Oh, sure. Bambi.
Bambi.
Terrifying.
With the fire?
Terrifying. Oh, and the death of the parents, you know. Mm-hmm. Dumbo. You know, the scene where Dumbo is being separated from his mother. Because these are things that censors who are worried about what children can take and what they can't take seem never to understand, is that a child's perspective on things is quite different from an adult. And separation from the parents is one of the huge traumatic things that exist in a kid's mind. And so I can say that the original Blue Lagoon movie, not the Brooke Shields one, the one way earlier with John Hall, there were scenes in that. That was the movie that made me sleep with the lights on for a week. It's about a couple of kids who are on a boat. The boat catches fire and sinks, and the kids are the only ones left alive, and they swim to this nearby island, and they grow up in isolation on the island. But it's the fact that they're alone, you know, that their parents have died. That was the terrifying thing about that movie for me.
Hmm. And did that contribute to you wanting to make movies?
I doubt it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I always thought I would be a writer, and I even at that early age, I thought that I would be a writer. And my father was a writer. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. I used to fall asleep to the sound of his typewriter, you know. So, so I was a kind of a surprise when I found myself being a filmmaker. It was really not something I had ever anticipated, and it really didn't come to me until I was at the University of Toronto. So it was relatively late in life compared with some of the Hollywood wunderkinder whose fathers were in the film business and so on. So they had a lot of models for that, and I didn't have that. I had a model for writing, really.
David Cronenberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
David Cronenberg, speaking to Terry Gross last year. His most recent film, A History of Violence, has just been released on DVD. Later, David Edelstein reviews V for Vendetta, another film, also based on a graphic novel, built around themes of violence and human nature. But first, coming up, rock historian Ed Ward unearths a mostly forgotten girl group from the 1960s. This is Fresh Air. With a name that sounds like an extraterrestrial life form, Reparata and the Delrons was the last girl group of the 1960s, poised somewhere between the Shangri-Las and the Mamas and the Papas. Fronted by a feisty Irish-American gal from Brooklyn, they managed to hang on in a decade whose pop music had passed them by. Rock historian Ed Ward takes another listen.
Hi, this is Reparata
and the Delrons,
and we're here to tell you about...
Mary Izzy O'Leary is a retired schoolteacher now, but once upon a time, she was Reparata. It was her confirmation name, and let's face it, it sounds better than Mary and the Delrons. In 1963, as a Brooklyn high school student, she and three friends started singing together and eventually won a talent contest that got them an audition with a local record company. The record that eventually emerged didn't set the nation on fire, but it did okay in parts of Long Island. The Delrons were managed by the Jerome brothers, Bill and Steve, and they had big plans for the girls. First, they put Mary, Reparata, out front. Next, they found a label, World Artists, which was having success with Chad and Jeremy, and signed them to it, and the girls had their first hit.
My mama said to me, do you really love that guy? Does he
Whenever a Teenager Cries got to number 60 on the national charts in January 1965 and would be the trio's biggest hit. That's fairly remarkable when you consider what else was going on in pop music at the time, and that Reparata and the Delrons were something of a throwback to an earlier era. But it's also worth remembering that, particularly on the East Coast, the British Invasion and the Beatles were seen as foreign interlopers, and there was still a demand for homemade pop music like the Delrons and the Four Seasons were making. None of which kept world artists from going bankrupt, right as it was time to pay royalties on Whenever a Teenager Cries, of course. But the Jeromes had friends at RCA, and even though Mary's original two Delrons had quit due to parental disapproval of the group's touring schedule, a new trio went into the studio, with the Jeromes producing, and their musical director, Harry Lukowski, who called himself Hash Brown, doing the arrangements.
Ever since I can remember, his love has been warm and tender. The only boy I've ever known, the only boy I've ever shown my love to, and now he's gone.
I'm Nobody's Baby Now is one of the most perfect clones of the Phil Spector sound ever released, but even Phil Spector was finding it harder to sell records in 1965. RCA kept the girls on through the middle of 1967, when they released another out-of-time classic.
It may be
Jeromes then moved the Delrons over to Mala Records, a division of Bell Records, which had just opened an office in London. In a surprise move, this trio of throwbacks to the pre-British invasion period wound up having a smash hit in England in 1968. Time was catching up with Reparata and the Delrons, whose records were doing nothing in the States. Mary herself got married in 1969 and happily handed the name of the group off to Lorraine Mazzola, who continued until 1973, when she disbanded the group and joined Barry Manilow, an obscure saloon singer, as a backup vocalist. In 1975, Mary made a single called Shoes about a Greek wedding and released it under the name Reparata. The next thing she knew, she was being sued by a group called Lady Flash, Barry Manilow's backup group, and told that Lorraine Mazzola was the real Reparata. The suit went on for years, but today Mary Aisi O'Leary is reparata again and custodian of the legacy of the last girl group of its era.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews V for Vendetta. This is Fresh Air. You've probably seen photos of actress Natalie Portman with her head shaved. Many of them are accompanied by the caption, "Natalie Portman with her head shaved." The movie for which she cut her hair is V for Vendetta. She plays a young English girl taken under the wing of a masked revolutionary, played by Hugo Weaving. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The comic book thriller V for Vendetta unfolds in a totalitarian Britain of the near future, some years after a devastating terrorist attack has led the government to put the kibosh on civil liberties. The model for the 80s graphic novel by Alan Moore and David Lloyd was clearly the Soviet Union by way of Orwell, but it was Britain's Thatcherism that inspired the project, and in the movie, it's hard to miss the mischievous jibes at the present U.S. regime. As written by the Wachowski brothers of The Matrix fame, V for Vendetta is not an earnest civics lesson like Good Night and Good Luck. The masked Avenger, who calls himself V, blows things up real good, and he gleefully chases his conflagrations with fireworks and a booming 1812 overture. Early in the film, V, played by Hugo Weaving, picks up a protege, aptly named Evie, and played by Natalie Portman, and he lectures her in the ethos of muckraking, burlesque, sexual freedom, and anarchism. He proclaims that people should not be afraid of their governments should be afraid of them. Given his habit of assassinating apparatchiks, exploding landmarks, and hijacking state-controlled propagandistic TV networks, his government is certainly afraid of him. With even retired Supreme Court Justice and Reagan appointee Sandra Day O'Connor warning recently of the beginnings of a dictatorship in this country, it seems like the perfect moment for this movie, which is often ridiculous, but more often riotously enjoyable. Like The Matrix, it's something of a pop hodgepodge, but I'm happy to say without that trilogy's ponderous religious allegory. V is part Zorro and part Cyrano, with a touch of Tim Burton's Batman. He's also disfigured, like the Phantom of the Opera. His mask is modeled on Guy Fawkes, who was executed in 1605 for his attempt to dynamite the English Parliament. And it's remarkable how alive that smiling, papier-mâché Fawkes visage seems, especially when it's underscored by Weaving's rolling baritone. Weaving was the Antichrist Agent Smith in The Matrix, and he's brilliant here, a hambone with a rapier edge. Evie is a fairly colorless ingenue, but Natalie Portman's watchfulness and unaffected beauty keep you entranced and keep the movie from drifting into camp. Whatever else it is, V for Vendetta is not frivolous. One of the Wachowskis is reportedly in the midst of a sex change, and the film introduces a lesbian martyr to make a plaintive case for the right to be what one is. V's underground lair is crammed with works of art and literature forbidden by the government, and the penalty for possession is imprisonment or worse. In a grueling sequence, Evie finds herself charged with sedition.
Do you know why you're here, Evie Hammond?
Please.
You've been formally charged with 3 counts of murder, the bombing of government property, conspiracy to commit terrorism, treason, and sedition, the penalty for which is death by firing squad. You have one chance, and only one chance, to save your life. You must tell us the identity or whereabouts of Codename V. If your information leads to his capture, you will be released from this facility immediately. Do you understand what I'm telling you? You can return to your life, Miss Hammond. All you have to do is cooperate.
After Evie's head is shaved and she endures a marathon mental torture session, she emerges with a new fearlessness, and we expect great things. It's a lapse in the screenwriting that she's barely tested. She's like a Joan of Arc who never fights. And I wish that John Hurt's fascist chancellor, who's mostly seen on video monitors, weren't such an old-fashioned Hitler type. The movie might have seemed fresher, with more up-to-the-minute satire. But the director, James McTeague, who was the assistant director on the Matrix movies, achieves a delirious swashbuckler tone with splashes of bejeweled blood and dollops of Grand Guignol horror. V relishes his complicated schemes, and so does McTeague, who devises an amazing montage around the image of V exulting over a field of tumbling dominoes. V for Vendetta will doubtless outrage conservatives and unnerve fuddy-duddies with its magisterial irresponsibility. For the rest of us, the movie's pop art mixture of revolutionary symbols from history, literature, and painting is one subversive hoot.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Intuition, a novel by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org. And from Acura, sponsor of NPR podcasting, newscasts and hourly news summaries available at npr.org/podcasts. This is NPR. National Public Radio. The New York City Opera has revived the Frank Lesser musical, The Most Happy Fella. On the next Fresh Air, we meet the star of the original production and the woman who became Frank Lesser's wife, Jo Sullivan Lesser. Also, folklorist and musician Mick Maloney revives theater songs from the late 1800s. Join us for the next Fresh Air.